written by Rowan Atkinson and Richard Curtis, and produced by Griff Rhys-Jones. From 1979, we look at the career of the Knight of the Theatre, and the first of the Atkinson people.
Too hot, to mingle friendship far is mingling bloods. I have tremor cordis on me, my heart dances, but not for joy, joy. Oh, this is entertainment my bosom likes not, nor my brows.
Today, this man is 60.
Why, that's my bawcock. What has smutched thy nose?
He is one of England's greatest actors.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players.
We take this opportunity to look back over the industrious... I'm so sorry... illustrious career of this country's noblest knight of the knightly performers, Sir Corin Bason.
Oh, foul room of night!
In the most competitive, backbiting, ambition-ridden...
Oh, foul ambition!
...and disillusioning business of them all.
All! All!
In the theatre, only a very few make it to the top of the tree. Most are content to sit quiet in a lower branch. Others climb higher, but fall and break their spines. And some, of course, are in a different forest altogether. But Sir Corin Bason is at the very top. We chose his 60th birthday as an opportunity to talk at length with Sir Corin, sending Gerald Steele, veteran journalist and broadcaster, to talk with him.
Sir Corin Bason?
Yes.
When was it that you first became interested in the theatre?
Oh, that's a long story. As a very young boy, I was very shy and nervous.
Nervous, yes.
Yes, nervous. And often I didn't dare go out.
Dare go out, yes.
Please.
Please, yes.
No, please stop interrupting me.
Stop interrupting, yes.
Good. Well, one day my nurse...
Nurse, yes.
One day my nurse made me go out to watch a show by Douglas Bing.
Bing, yes.
Yes, Douglas Bing.
Bing, yes.
Yes, Bing, Douglas Bing, the famous female impersonator.
Male impersonator, yes.
Female impersonator.
Female impersonator, yes.
This was, don't you know...
No, yes.
About 60 years ago, so his career was really just starting.
Starting, yes.
Starting.
Starting, yes.
Yes, starting.
Yes, starting, yes.
Do be quiet.
Quiet, yes.
Stop talking.
Talking, yes.
Stop it.
Stop it, yes.
Stop saying what I'm saying.
Saying yes.
And then saying yes.
Saying yes, yes.
We decided to allow Sir Corin to tell his story in his own words. He begins with a description of his earliest memories.
My family, of course, always say that I gave my finest performance at birth, although I tend to feel my Tamburlaine at the Old Vic might have the edge on it. My father was a very intolerant man. He disliked most things except some types of brandy and Indian servants, but particularly he disliked women and children. If ever he saw me about the house, he'd get down on all fours and start barking at me and trying to take a bite out of the seat of my trousers. He was one of the last great eccentrics. And then there was my mother's brother, Oliver Turnbull. My father used to say that Oliver was a great wag, and they used to sit up late and talk and... wag, I suppose. My mother, of course, used to be left tied upstairs when Ollie visited... but for her to have complained would only have meant another threshing for me. My father said that threshing was very good for me, since it taught me that the world was a difficult place, which wasn't quite true. It rather taught me that my father was a vicious sadist. But perhaps on reflection, the two things do come to the same one thing. In this habit of beating me, he resembled, I always felt...
It is often difficult to draw Sir Corin away from his familial meditations, and we take this opportunity to remind listeners of one of Sir Corin's early triumphs, the part of Terence, in the little-known Jacobean Gothic tragedy, The Tragedy of Terence, or The Recalcitrant Lunatic. As we join the recording, Terence, overacted by Sir Corin, is walking down a corridor in a castle in 16th-century Italy.
Ah, now I am alone. Oh, woe, they do think that I am mad, but no, I do but counterfeit. And have a plan most cunning, and yet most cunning, most slippery sly, and yet most slyly slipper. But wait! Here comes my brother, the usurper. See him smile. He feels he's on a winning wicket. Little does he know that in a trice he'll kick it.
Hail, Terence. How goes it?
Most porky, my lad. Most porky.
I see thou art as much hair still.
I'm mad. Aye, my lad. Mad I am. Ooh, but I can gauge a spurt some packy and whopper lusty dago.
Away, away. Thou ravest.
No.
is thou that ravest foul usurper? Prepare to meet thy doom. See, I cast aside my madman's guise and stand before thee the man I was, thy wronged brother, fair Antonio.
Away, loon.
I am no loon. I am thy wronged brother, fair Antonio.
Loon, I do begin to tire of thee. I have no brother, nor is Antonio's name a name beknown to me.
No?
No.
Then say I am none other than thy father, Rivello, foully murdered.
My father is alive and well.
Is it even so?
Aye,
it's... Then I am thy beloved sister, Antonio.
I have no sister.
No, then must I be no other but mad Terence, the fetid stirp.
True, loon. Away, I am full of business.
Next time, perchance, I shall thrive.
I should go into the West End and to the theatres and see matinees as often as possible. As for my sister... She was an odd bod, really. She was my twin, and so we had a very close physical affinity. We often used to play doctors and nurses, which in those days meant that I fed her poisonous herbs, and she attached leeches to the parts of me which hurt. It had an ironic effect on both of us. I went on to play Dr. Faustus, and she went on to become a registered nurse. I remember once sitting in the green room waiting for the show to go up one evening when...
We'd like to interrupt the programme at this point with a short explanation to those who are new to theatre of some of the jargon at present in common use. Let's hear that word used in a sentence.
Do you want to hear some jargon back at my place?
Jargon is a word used to describe words or phrases that have a unique meaning to a particular field of enterprise.
I have an enterprise planned for 2 o'clock.
In the world of the theatre, one of the most common of these special words is flies. Flies are the stage machinery from which items of scenery can be raised or lowered, that is, flown out or flown in. Here are some more typical uses.
I'm flying tonight. Are you? He is stuck in the flies. I'm Larry. Fly me.
For stage positioning, upstage and downstage should be self-explanatory.
I am downstage. Is that you, upstage?
Although there is a special application of the word upstage to the activity of stealing the limelight.
You upstaged me, you bastard.
The stage flat is possibly the most used and most useful of all stage machinery. And despite its potential ambiguity, the word is rarely confusing in use.
What a nice flat. Did you paint it yourself? This flat is not flat. I'm a flat. Fly me.
And lastly, to the safety curtain that is required to appear for a minimum period during the interval of any public performance. From the material with which it is constructed, it is known as the iron.
Why isn't the iron down? I thought it was supposed to be...
And now back to Sir Corin Basin.
And school plays and in dramatic readings as often as possible. After home, school was wonderful, and it was at school that I first met Harold Foster, Sir, as I knew him then, who was assistant housemaster at my house, Ricketts, and turned out to be one of the greatest influences on my acting career. It was he who taught me truly to identify with characters. He used to invite me round to dinner. He didn't have a wife. And on my invitation card would be a name, be it Cleopatra or Caliban, which character I would have to pretend to be throughout the evening. There were tricky moments, as when he invited me to be Hamlet's father, and I had to spend the entire evening saying nothing until he ended up pouring brandy down my ear and inviting me to come back the next week as a ghost, which was equally testing, since while I had a great deal to say, primarily about revenge, I could eat little, being physiologically insubstantial. I had to put up with my fair share of bullying, like everybody else. Things were often pretty rough. For punishment, we had to learn the Aeneid backwards, or write a 10-side essay entitled 100 Ways with Vegetables, which, as you can imagine, was fairly alarming for someone as sensitive as myself. And then I could be put on bikes, a punishment in which I had to chase the house prefects who were on motor bicycles round the running track, and if they caught up with me rather than vice versa, they were allowed, indeed obliged, either to beat me with canes or pull out strands of my hair before rushing off to give me another chance of catching up with them. Still, I often go back there, and it's heartening to see some of the old masters, some of whom must now be in their 120s, still going on with their old duties and referring to me affectionately, as they always did, as Baldy. Only a few years ago I went back, I remember, one speech day to give praise.
Sir Corin does not mention that at school his practical acting experience did in fact range over the entire dramatic spectrum. In his last year, he played the part of Philoctetes in a production of Euripides' great drama in the original Greek. We join his performance at the point where Philoctetes, his green septic foot causing him unspeakable pain, has just discovered that Neoptolemus has come to fetch him, not out of love, but as a lackey of his greatest enemy, Odysseus, who stands nearby and hears the speech of the injured man. Philoctetes talks of the lost concepts of honour and humanism.
Oh, my moros, kai pat...
Well, there's no point listening to that since no one understands a word nowadays. Even so, it was a very moving performance, and the plaudits Sir Corin received encouraged him to try for RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
Theatre in the evening as often as possible. The first step towards a successful acting career in those days, apart from the traditional one in our profession, which is over the backstabbed remains of one's most talented contemporaries, was to go to drama school. I chose RADA, but in fact entered Central School since I failed the exam at RADA, which in those days consisted in identifying what the initials RADA stood for. My time at Central was slightly clouded by the fact that I was again badly bullied, particularly by Robert Morley and Edith Evans. But there was always sunshine on the horizon in the shape of the greatest influence on my career in those days, the then-famous character actress and part-time tutor, Brenda Lofthouse.
No, I'm not sure that I do remember him. Oh, dear. I seem to have dropped my cup. I am sorry. Do you mind if I just go and fetch another cup? Oh, I'm so sorry. Where were we? Oh, yes. Basin. Oh, yes. The name does ring a... Oh, dear. There it goes again. Oh, excuse me, if you will. Just a second while I get myself another cup. Yes. Yes, I do remember the name. But that may well be because I've just been doing a lot of washing up. Oh, silly me. Well, I think this time I'll just bring the pot over. Nothing like a good cup of tea for keeping one strong in the long hours of the afternoon. Now, let me cast my mind back. Oh, dear, I'm sorry. Well, I believe it doesn't stain badly, however.
And I used to nip off from official lessons and go off to have private tuition from Brenda as often as possible. Brenda offered me the invaluable advice that only two things are necessary for an actor to remember. To speak his lines loud and clear, and always to bump into the furniture. This added to the realism of the piece and so irritated the other actors that I was bound to outshine them. Of course, today drama schools are run very differently, as I discovered when recently I visited an old friend of mine who is now teaching at a drama school.
Right, quiet, please, everyone. Quiet, shh. Right, now, to start today, I want you all to be trees and to plant yourselves and to grow. All right? With the music. Michael, did you hear what I said?
I want to be a window.
Sorry?
I thought I was going to be a window.
You thought you were going to be a window?
Yeah.
You were a window on Tuesday, Michael, and we could all see straight through you, couldn't we, class?
Yes, Mickey.
And who cleaned Michael on Tuesday?
I did.
Yes, you did, didn't you, Sophie? Mm-hmm. And you, Jason, you were the chamois leather.
I pulled the ladder away.
No, you didn't pull the ladder away, Sebastian. You were the ladder, and you fell over. Right. Now, from the top, please. Are we ready? With the music. Feel it, now feel it, you're just a little seed. Make yourself really small, like a
baby. It must always be the imagination, in my opinion, that's put to work before the bodily function. You see, the likes of Sir Corin here, I mean, he learnt his trade from statuesque Shakespeare, which for me is just one long, tedious, poetic deceit. You know, chap walks on stage and says, I am a lion. And you think, oh, yes, you know, pull the other one, sweetheart. Second chap walks on and says, lummy, he says, how thou roarest. Then to complete the scene, third chap walks on and says, I lion too. We're all bloody lying, if you ask me. There's not a grain of truth between them.
Planted yourself yet. We've got to delve deep down now, Valentine. Down. Valentine, what are you doing? The floor was only polished this morning. Valentine, for goodness.
Listen to what the older actors had to say and get advice from them as often as possible. One actor that I had little difficulty outshining in those days was Timothy Gaskell, whose performance of the storm scene in King Lear was described by a prominent theatre critic of the time as resembling the drunken stumblings of a rabid Covent Garden flower seller after an unsuccessful sex change operation. I believe he makes his money nowadays writing books about the royal family.
Oh, he's a superman, and a gorgeous, lovely, lovely actor. He's just one of those actors with that indefinable something, that je ne sais quoi, of that genre that says, je suis un homme, je ne suis pas une femme. And he has that presence, of course, that command of stage, that arrogance, that charisma, that sheer zonk. It's all there in his each and every performance, as Hamlet at Farndon before the war, as Elvis in Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat in Glasgow in 75, and as the young Duke of a Lamp Heath in the Halo of My Sainted Aunt trilogy at Norwich. And, of course, a greed for adulation was very much a part of him. He loved the roar of the crowd, the big cars, the expensive restaurants, the beautiful people, the beautiful cars, the expensive people and the big restaurants, the expensive cars, the beautiful restaurants, and the big people. And money. Those were and are his life and loves.
Of course, I used to dash off to the theatre in the evenings on absolutely every possible occasion. Of course, when I left RADA, suddenly I found that the war was upon us. My father went off to join the Germans, and I applied to join the army. Sadly, I was turned down for reasons. But I then threw myself straight into the melting pot of British war effort movies and took part in such films as Bombs Away, Slaughter the Jerrys, and the riotous Watch It Hitler. But perhaps the film I enjoyed most, although my own part was very small, was in a film that came late in the war, glorifying the landing on the Normandy beaches. It gave me the opportunity to work with the legendary lighting cameraman Carl Biskin.
Weather's pretty rough, eh, Corporal?
Pretty damn rough, Scungy, pretty damn rough.
Think we'll make it there, Corps?
Oh, think we will, Spotty, think we damn well will.
Corps?
What's that, Bunty?
Freddy's looking pretty rough.
Better try the old saltwater treatment.
Okay, sir. One.
No, two, not that ill. Hey, hold it,
three.
Corps, what?
Freddy asked me to give you this as a memento.
My God, what a man. What is it, Porky?
Hand grenade, Corpse.
Doesn't look like a hand grenade. It's missing that little clip thing.
That's right, sir. Freddy took it with him, sir, so that even in separation, in a tiny way, you'd still be together.
Oh, how moving, Porky. How bloody moving.
Bloody stupid, too, if I may say so, Corpse.
Yes, there, too.
Only hours later, they reached the beaches.
Corpse, we're here.
Where's that, Grotty?
France, Corpse.
Doesn't look like France. Too many bloody jerrys.
That's why we're here, Corpse. Get rid of the bloody jerrys.
Too true, too true. We better get on with it, then. Grotty, out.
Right, Corpse.
Oh! Snotty, you're next.
Right, Corpse.
Ah! Potty, off you go.
I think I'll give this one a miss, Corpse.
What's that, Potty?
Can't move a bloody inch, Corpse. I think I'd better sit this one out.
Nonsense, get out there.
Can't, sir. Can't move a bloody inch. Cramp, sir.
Nonsense, get a move on.
Can't, sir. Cramp, sir. Can't move a bloody inch. Always get it when I've been sitting down too long.
All right, Potts. But I hope you're not malingering or there'll be trouble.
Right you are, Corpse.
Now look, watch the boat till I get back. Take this. It could be handy if any jerrys drop by.
Right, Corpse. What is it?
Hand grenade, Potts.
Doesn't look like a hand grenade, Corpse. It's missing that little...
That's right, Potts. Bit of a bore.
Oh, you can say that again, Corpse.
Fair enough. Bit of a bore.
Well, I still used to do that a great deal. But as a blind man is little without his dog, so an actor is nothing without his director, and I should pay tribute to all those directors who have squeezed every last drop out of the lemon of my talent. Men like Spigot, Ramblinsky, Bartok and Monk. A young director that I always particularly admire and enjoy working with is David Feat. David is a young man with enormous promise. He's just begun rehearsals on a new play at the Royal Court, Death Beetle. I'm told it's a powerful drama about a gay locksmith. I understand that rehearsals are going very well.
Darling, I've got something very important to say to you.
What's that, my dear?
I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
That's all right. I didn't want any.
Well, I'd better come out with it, then. I've just murdered your lover.
No, now, Steve, your first line.
Sorry, darling, I've got something very important to say to you.
Right, it's followed by your second line.
No, sorry,
it's followed by Joan's first line, which is followed then by your second line.
Yes.
What is it?
Sorry, I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
Sorry, I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
Sorry, no, I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
Sorry, no, I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
No, all I said, David, was, I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
I'm afraid we're out of coffee. I've got something important to say. I'm afraid we're out of coffee. It's important, you see. It's crucial to the entire play. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, from the top.
Darling, I've got something very important to say to you.
Good.
What's that, darling?
I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
Bigger, Stephen, please.
Surely, David, the passionate line comes later. I've just murdered your lover.
Peter, we're dealing in this play with a highly intelligent man.
Of course.
So why should he lie at this time? I have something important to say. I'm afraid we're out of coffee. It really is that simple. Again, please.
Darling, I've got something important to say to you.
Good, good, good.
What's that, my dear?
Knockout.
I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
No, Peter, passion.
I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
More!
I can't do it anymore.
Good, good. Better from the top.
Darling, I've got something to say to you.
What's that?
I'm afraid we're out of coffee.
Don't worry, I didn't want any.
Well, I'd better come out with it, then. I've just murdered your lover.
Okay, good. Marvellous. Yes, it's a start.
David, look, surely, don't you think the focus could shift slightly?
Well, of course it could. We could make cars without wheels, but they wouldn't be a lot of use.
Well, that's true.
Right, come on, let's get it right.
Can I say something?
What?
I'm afraid we're out of coffee!
It's coming, it's coming.
Absolutely. You're quite right, and for those reasons, I've always tried to keep in touch with the theatre. Nevertheless, if a worthwhile offer comes to me from television or the cinema, I do not, as some, turn it down as a matter of principle. This was my reasoning when I accepted the part of John Mackin, the father in the BBC prestige serial about life on a pre-war Merseyside farm. I enjoy doing a strong character part again, and for the record, I also happen to believe that in its social realism and compassion, the programme was a great milestone in television situation comedy.
Morning, Mum.
Morning, Dad, stupid.
Morning, Dad.
That's not your dad, stupid. That's a cow.
Looks a lot like Dad, though.
Shut up and eat your food.
What is it, then?
Manure butty.
Oh, great, my favourite.
I'm glad you like it. Fresh this morning. Morning, George.
Shut up, you old cow.
That wasn't a cow, Dad. That was Mum.
Shut up, stupid, or I'll throw you in the trough with the rest of your friends. Then you really will make a pig of yourself. Come on, ugly, that manure should be ready by now. Some of us have work to do. Really part of a great tradition, I think it's fair to say. And so rambling as I have, like a sedentary Dr. Johnson through the realms of my modest career, I seem to have reached the present time. Prospects are, the Lord, if he exists, be praised, still as rosy as ever they were. Oh, only a few weeks from now I start rehearsals of Harold Pintangle's new drama Menace, in which I play a chair-bound playwright married to a friend of his wife's, and Sir Ralph Dennis plays the menace in the form of a mysterious and menacing stranger whom I may or may not have met 30 years earlier in a cinema showing a pre-release version of Watership Down, starring Robert Newton as a one-legged rabbit and Leslie Ann Down as a ruthless seductress who leads him to ruin while pretending to lead him to a radish patch near Swindon. Meanwhile, I
have, as you probably know, just finished filming a new movie based on Dame Agatha's Murder by Misfortune. I believe it's making a great deal of money.
Very well, the time has come for all to be revealed. I want to see you all in the drawing room in 20 seconds. Very good. I'm glad to see you all here. I am sorry I'm late. A touch of the indigestibles, you understand. I apologize.
That's all right.
But why am I apologizing, I ask me, eh? Here in this very drawing room in an English country house is sitting a man or woman or servant responsible for four horrible murders, and it is he or she or the servant who will have to be fating les apologies. But first, let us look at the circumstances of the murders. 3 days ago, we all arrived here on the invitation of Lady Greed for a pleasant weekend in the country. Within a day, Lady Greed, her butler Spank, her maid Miss Stingway, and her son and direct heir, the Honorable Gavin Greed, were all dead. Now, I, Hercule Poirot, swiftly realize when looking over the fourth grotesquely disfigured corpse that something here was not quite due to natural causes. I thought to myself, who has a motive for these hideous crimes? Could it be you, Felicity Slaughter, frustrated widowed sister of Lady Greed, your husband horribly murdered in Ghana while performing a secret missive for Lord Greed?
No, it wasn't.
Shut up! Or was it you, baby-faced Goering, frustrated and mentally retarded playmate of Gavin Greed, in revenge for the permanent damage done to your brain by Lady Greed when she caught you in hanky-panky with Miss Stingway?
No, I don't think
it was. Keep quiet! No, you see, it wasn't you, was it? Nor, I hazard a guess, was it you, Miss Von Murderer? Nor you, Felicity Slaughter? Nor you, Colonel Stiff? But it was...
It wasn't me.
Shut up, babyface! Let us look again at the scenes of the murders. A stairway, another stairway, a mine, and a sandpit. What do they all have in common, eh? Eh?
We don't know.
No, it took me, a stupid fat Belgian with a dyed moustache, to find the common denominator. These were all places likely to be frequented by a person with a hideous mole on his left cheek.
Oh, my God!
Yes, the murderer was not Babyface Goering. It was you, Carla Von Murderer, your mole having been removed in a motorcycle accident on your way to take up residence here.
No, it wasn't me. I never hid a mole.
So, not you, Carla. And so you, Felicity, you...
No, it wasn't me.
Which leaves only you, Colonel Stiff.
Sorry, not me.
So, none of you did it, is that right?
That's right.
Are you absolutely sure?
Absolutely.
Then I submit that the murderer was none other than you, Miss Doris Fortune, the mute chambermaid.
Murder by misfortune.
Do you deny it? Did you kill all four of these people? If no, say no. If yes, just remain silent. Aha! Aha! Uh-huh. Ladies and gentlemen, we have our murderer.
Well done, Mr. Wunderbar!
We wish to thank Sir Corin for his cooperation in the making of this program, and to welcome back Gerald Steele, because to finish off our tribute, we have asked Gerald to quiz Sir Corin just a little further about his future.
The part of Poirot was, of course, the climax of a long connection between yourself and Dame Agatha's works, wasn't it?
No.
No, it wasn't. And so with feelings of great regret and nostalgia, you went on to your new project.
No.
So with little regret, you went on to your next project, a classic serial adaptation of the life of famous television adapter Simon Raven.
No.
Far more preferable, indeed, was to take the leading role of the plumber's mate in the acclaimed BBC situation comedy Yours Aren't Big Enough.
No.
No, you didn't. You embarked upon your first feature as a director.
No.
Directing the film of The Adventures of Marie Antoinette.
No.
Starring Jodie Foster as Marie Antoinette.
No.
As Louis XVI.
No.
You embarked upon your first project as a director to make the film of the life of Jodie Foster.
No.
No, you didn't. Instead, you decided to take a break from all acting or directing jobs and see if you could earn money, say, by being interviewed by, say, Michael Parkinson.
No.
Me?
Yes.
Oh, fine. Well, Sir Corin, where from here?
Your next question, I imagine.
And after that?
The next question.
And so on to...
The next question.
Followed by...
The next question.
And then where? The next question
after that. We leave you with Sir Corin to provide the last word.
My father once told me... Peter, he could never remember my name, you see. Peter, he said, if I had a personality like yours, I'd spend the rest of my life pretending I was somebody else. It was the best piece of advice I ever had.
That was Sir Corin Bateson talking to anyone who happened to be listening. Sir Corin is a member of our wonderful National Theatre.
Very enlightening. And the man behind the headlines that will be revealed next week is one of the greatest living Britons. That's living in 1979. Renaissance man Sir Benjamin Fletcher. The Atkinson People featured Rowan Atkinson, Hugh Thomas, Peter Wilson and Hilda Kriesman. It was written by Rowan Atkinson and Richard Curtis and produced by Griff Rhys-Jones.